This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. Word of mouth may be a great way to learn about some products, but word of mouth gardening tips can be a very bad idea. The age-old practice of passing along gardening tips and tricks is no guarantee you will get a good result. It might even do the opposite. In her new book, garden expert and author C.L. Frenari looks at 71 common garden practices and uncovers the truth behind the lore. And so we're going to talk about coffee for roses and 70 other misleading myths about backyard gardening. And I have with me on the line Ms. Frenari. Thank you for joining me on the program.
It is my pleasure.
So what was the impetus for the book? You just got tired of people saying, oh, yeah, you're supposed to do this, and then you had to tell them, well, actually, no.
It's funny because I answer gardening questions from people all the time, and certain myths keep coming up, you know, or certain people say, well, I needed to get rid of, you know, the skunk under the shed, so I threw out mothballs or whatever. And about, it was probably 10 years ago, I started doing a talk on this topic called Myths, Lies, and All the Latest Dirt. And last year, I was negotiating a contract with St. Lin's Press to do a book on annuals, and the publisher looked at my website and saw this talk, and he said to me, well, you know, I'd really rather do a book on that. So the annuals got put to the side, and Coffee for Roses was born.
So I was intrigued with the introduction. Tell me about your first experience with your horticulture enterprise in Muncie, Indiana.
Yes, well, my first experience as a professional in horticulture was when I was around 9 years old, and a friend and I decided that we needed something sweet, and we didn't have any money, so how do you get money when you're that age? You sell something and hope that you're cute enough that people will buy it. So we scrambled around and took some flower pots, let me say stole some flower pots from behind the garage of the house that my parents were renting, and we filled them with dirt from behind that same garage, and then we scampered around the neighborhood picking flowers from people's gardens and came back, stuck the stems right in the pots of dirt and loaded them into the radio flyer wagon and sold them door to door, often to the same people that we had stolen them from in the first place. So, and I guess, you know, we must have been cute because people did buy them. So I've learned a lot about both ethics and the importance of root systems since.
So one of the things in your book talks about how humans tend to be prone to looking at, you know, either overreacting, downright wackiness. And one of the things that I saw in here was growing peppers. I'd never heard of planting peppers with a few matchsticks under each plant. So why
isn't that a bizarre one? That's one that lives its life on the internet, right?
I mean, is it supposed to make it hotter?
Somebody at some point decided to give a pepper plant a hot foot and stick peppers in the roots of the plant before planting. And there are all kinds of theories online as to why this is a good idea, most of them completely nonsensical. But I think that's an example of people being drawn to the quirky, you know, the unusual, or something that uses one thing that we're familiar with, matches, for a completely bizarre purpose. I think people are drawn to that sort of thing.
I think it's the easiness of it, too, because you can, I've got matches. I can just try this out.
Right, exactly.
And see what works. Let's look right at the first one. That was the first one that jumped out at me. A perennial garden is less work than an annual planting because the plants come up every year.
This is something that I hear almost daily at the garden center where I work. And people come in and say, I don't want to do the work of planting annuals anymore. Where are the perennials? And any gardener who's listening now who has a perennial garden knows that perennials, they're wonderful. They're fantastic. But it is the most high-maintenance garden you can plant. And It's wonderful for providing a kaleidoscope of color that changes through the season. That's the beauty of perennials, but you should never plant them because they're less work.
Your number three is pass along plants from neighbors or plant sales are a great way to plant a perennial garden. And I used to think that way, but you highlight exactly why that's not always such a great idea.
Well, I quote my friend Stephanie Foster, who is also a garden writer, and she once said to me, I have one rule. Never accept a plant someone else wants to give you. There's a reason they have it to give away. So, and, I don't have that rule myself. I do take plants from other people, but, those plants tend to spread, and so they need to be edited. And not only that, those plants often come along with hitchhikers that you really don't want in your garden.
Like,
so
what kind
I've
of hitchhikers?
Some pretty aggressive weeds by taking pass-along plants.
I think you mentioned bishop's weed was one of those that you ended up getting, and the only way you got rid of it was by moving?
Does that thrive in your area?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, here too. It's a plague on the planet.
Well, and I suppose that a lot of it is really knowing what you're getting in the first place. I mean, I do a lot of trading with folks in the local Iris Society because I know what varieties they have, and
sure.
I know what I have, and it's great. It works really well. But when I took that Centaria plant, I shouldn't have done it because now I've got Centaria growing all over the place.
Yeah, that's one of them that. It's a plant I call a party crasher. It shows up at the party whether it's invited or not. And some party crashers, you let them stay because they come so colorfully dressed. But that one, it doesn't even have so much color to make it worth putting up with. So
I wanted to move along to talking about color attractants for hummingbirds.
There are many red flowers that do attract hummingbirds. Monarda, for example, red bee balm, they love it. But it isn't the color that they're attracted to. I read some research from some scientists in Great Britain who discovered that what's important to hummingbirds is the same thing that's important to realtors: location, location, location. And once a hummingbird figures out that they can find a nectar source in a particular location, that's what's of interest to them. And should you have a hummingbird feeder that is red in a spot and move it 5 feet to the right or the left, the hummingbird will come to the old location, and if it's not there, it will fly off to another known location. It won't look left or right for something red. So I've concluded that the red on hummingbird feeders is to attract the people to buy them.
I'm talking with C.L. Fornari. She's author of the new book, Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. And C.L., one of the ones that also popped out at me was this one. It's number 10. Give annuals a fertilizer with a really high middle number to encourage more flowers and add superphosphate to the soil when planting perennials. When I put in my asparagus, I put in superphosphate because that's what it told me to do at the extension office. And when I put in my iris,
I learned these things as a new master gardener 20 years ago at our local extension office. Everybody did. We all learned this. And turns out, not only is phosphorus a pollutant, and now many states, including Massachusetts, where I live, are banning the use of phosphorus in gardens and farms, but also most plants don't need the amount that we were led to believe 20, 30 years ago.
So does it help any at all, for instance, in my asparagus bed with the new roots to get them established?
It would help if your soil is deficient in phosphorus.
But only if it's deficient. You're not doing any helping to the plant by adding extra if it doesn't need it.
That's right. And, for me, through my years of gardening, what I've come back to again and again is looking to see how nature gardens, and how plants grow in the natural world. And there's no little fertilizer fairy out there sprinkling fertilizer with a high middle number, you know, in the flower fields. So either plants flourish in your native soil or they don't. And most of us have pretty good, complete native soils. If we have a complete soil test done, most of us are in pretty good shape. And those people that happen to be deficient in one element or another, then they can supplement their soil. But, you know, you need to know what you're starting out with first. And for many of us, what we need to add is exactly what nature adds in the woods and the field, organic matter from the top down.
Mm. Well, I know that with the iris that I grow, if I don't have to put any extra fertilizer in when I get them planted or in the spring, that would be a tremendous help because it can be a lot of work.
Sure, sure. And, you know, anyone who does any amount of growing is well served to have a complete soil test done, you know, probably every 4 or 5 years. It might surprise you.
So. Well, and there is a plug. It's relatively inexpensive to get a soil test done through your local extension office in your county. I know in Utah, it's roughly about $15, $17 to get a basic test for phosphorus, potassium, and nitrogen. So
right.
Now
it's a good thing. It really is.
It makes sense to me when I read how you went about finding out. Well, what do you need to add? You went to someone who grows on a regular basis and is sending plants out to nurseries all the time, and they said that nitrogen was actually what they would add.
Well, it turns out that most annuals are nitrogen hogs. And the reason they are is they bloom on new growth, right? And so as long as they're growing, they are blooming. And what makes plants grow more? Nitrogen. And I was surprised, actually, to learn from the folks at Proven Winners that most of the new annuals come from places such as New Zealand and South Africa, where there is no phosphorus in the soil. So those plants wouldn't know what to do with it, you know, if you planted them in pure superphosphate. It wouldn't do them any good at all because they have developed genetically in places where they don't need phosphorus because it doesn't exist.
I love your number 14 myth. Squash, cucumbers, and pumpkins should be planted on mounds of soil. And I just, I laughed because I've always tried to do this. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, I thought, this is ridiculous. It's too hard for me to water this. I'm just going to dig a depression in the soil and plant my cantaloupe. And it's never been an issue for me. So when I read this, it's like, okay, well, this kind of makes sense why people would plant this way.
Well, it was so funny because for years, my husband and I, who we take great pleasure in vegetable gardening, and for years we piled up this, you know, mound of soil and planted our squash or cuke seeds on top of this mound because the package said to plant in hills. And then someone pointed out to me that the package was saying in hills, not on hills. What a difference one letter makes, right? Turns out hills is an old agricultural term for groups. And they were just telling me to group my plants. And for me, I garden in an area where the soils can be very sandy, and so it really makes much more sense for us to dig a bowl and plant in the bowl, and then we can cover with floating row cover and give those plants a good start in our cold springs, and then it's easier to water. So I've switched to planting cucumbers and squash. I plant my hills in valleys, let's say.
Well, it sure makes it a lot easier to garden in the valleys, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes it so much easier to water, and they don't dry up as quickly either, because when they're up on a mound of soil, those little roots of the developing plants dry up faster. There's more air exposure.
I do have flood irrigation, and that's what finally I just thought, this is absolutely ridiculous. I can't get enough moisture into that hill by having water flow up. It just doesn't work.
Right. So, well, it's interesting. And I think, you know, there are parts of the world where They have very heavy clay soils and torrential downpours at certain times in the summer. And for those people, planting on a raised area might make some sense. But for most of us, putting plants up on a mound of soil, it just doesn't work well.
I suppose one other advantage for a true hill would be that the soil warms up quicker in the spring, but you could pretty much just do that with black plastic.
Sure. Or the floating roll cover thing that I use. That makes a little greenhouse and warms that soil up really nicely. And it protects the young squash and cukes from insects like flea beetles as well. So it's a win-win thing to do the little bowl and put the floating row cover over them.
There we go. Well, I'm talking with C.L. Furnari. She's author of the new book, Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with the rest of the interview and looking at things such as plant clematis with their heads in the sun and their feet in the shade. We'll be right back. This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm talking with C.L. Furnari. She's author of Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. The next one that pops up for me, C.L., is the one about marigolds keeping bugs out of the vegetable garden. That's been drilled into me that I would do that, but that's not so much the case.
Oh, me too. For every year of our 42 years that my husband and I have planted a vegetable garden, we have put marigolds in the garden because we were told that marigolds keep insects away. And I compare this to the party game of telephone where, you know, the first person whispers a phrase in somebody's ear and then they whisper it to the next person and the next person and the next person. And by the time you get to the end, what that first person said is completely changed. And that's how this myth sort of came about. It started from a study that was done on harmful nematodes in the soil in the South, where they have a problem with nematodes in the soil. And they planted different fields with different crops, an extension service, a university down there, and then plowed the crops in at the end of the year and tested the soil the following year for nematodes. And the field that had been planted with Cygnet marigolds had a significantly reduced nematode population the following year. From that study came the belief that marigolds keep insects out of the garden. And yet no other study that tests companion planting of marigolds and other vegetable crops has shown that to be true. So now, do we still plant marigolds in our vegetable garden? Absolutely, because as my husband says, at this point, it's traditional.
You're cutting off the end of the pot roast, right? Not knowing quite why your mother or your grandmother did it. It's a tradition.
That's right. Well, for me, I mean, I continue to plant them because for me, nothing says summer like the smell of tomato foliage, basil foliage, and marigold foliage. That, to me, those three things, that's the scent of summer for me.
Mm. Now, I recall reading through these quite a number of items where you've seen the myths will morph, and it seems like the 18th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, things were pretty firm, but we get into this 20th century, and all of a sudden things start to change. Is that mostly just because of the ease of communication?
I think that has a lot to do with it, certainly. You know, whether it's national magazines and books. And the U.S. mail, of course, changed things dramatically in this country. Suddenly everybody got plant catalogs and garden magazines, and so that really stimulated quite a bit of the spread of things. But also I think that something about the 1950s or the post-war period, people began to be attracted to quick fixes. And I don't know whether that's because you know, more drugs came on the market. There were, you know, pills for cures. There were new products all the time. But it was right about, you know, post-war period when a lot of these myths started. And now, of course, they get spread on the internet. The backyard fence is now worldwide. So,
Number 17, yeah. You have, we must remove the suckers on tomato plants. And I used to do this all the time. I thought, this is too much work. So I quit doing it. But it looks like I shouldn't have been doing it in the first place.
Well, it's, you know, if you do remove the suckers, you do get slightly earlier tomatoes. On indeterminate varieties, however, you will also get fewer tomatoes because those suckers go on to become branches, which have flowers and bear fruit. And I don't, you know, I don't really want, I'm not in a competition with my neighbors to see who has the first tomato, although I did discover in researching this myth that tomato growing is somewhat of a competitive sport, that people do want to be the first on their flock to have a ripe tomato. But I want more tomatoes. That's what I want. And so I stopped taking suckers off plants. And why do we call them suckers anyway? They're not sucking anything off the plant. They're photosynthesizing and making energy.
While we're on tomatoes, this was one of the most bizarre myths. I've never heard of this before. For sweeter tomatoes, add sugar to the soil or water with sugar water.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's one that I found online. And, you know, it wouldn't that be nice if you could just pour some sort of flavoring on the ground and it would end up in your produce? I say in the book, you could pour bacon water and have a tomato that tastes like a BLT.
I wish that were so. Okay,
that's
so
right.
This is one that my mother told me to do. Deadhead roses by cutting down to the first set of five leaflets. That's number 27 in your book.
Yes, well, I was taught that, and I was out in my garden deadheading my roses going 1, 2, 3,
right.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, it reduced gardening to an episode of Sesame Street. And I was so relieved when I read a study that was done in Great Britain where they asked rosarians all over the country to deadhead roses using, you know, when they had more than one of the same kind of rose plant, to use that old method on one plant or half of the plants and then just take head shears and chop, chop, chop off of their heads with the others. And do you know they found to a rose garden that the ones that were deadheaded with the chop, chop, chop bloomed just as well and sometimes even better than the ones that were meticulously counted to leaflets? And I went back to journals done by professional rosarians, and they have long talked about what a silly idea this is. But I think, you know, we humans sometimes, we do want to help. It comes from a very sweet place in us. But I think sometimes the more complicated we make something, the more helpful we somehow believe it to be.
So basically just prune it back to the first set? You mean blossom
yeah,
off?
Or just chop off the heads, irregardless of where the leaflets are at all. Just cut off the developing seeds, which is the whole purpose of deadheading roses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is cutting off the developing seeds so the plant will grow more and bloom more. And so you just can literally take those head shears and go chop, 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 or that battery-operated shearing tool. That's one that I'm very fond of using.
So should you... This isn't in your book, just kind of a side note. Should you allow the roses to form hips toward the fall?
I think that depends on, first of all, how long your fall season is, whether you want the hips there for... The hips are beautiful, right? And some rose plants form beautiful rose hips that are gorgeous in fall arrangements. And so I think it's up to the gardener. I don't find, you know, I don't find any information from rosarians, professional rose people, that says that those hips being there or not being there does the plant any harm.
So that actually could be another myth. And I've heard, well, you let them go to hips because that helps the plant to prepare for the winter.
Well, it will stop the plant from flowering. However, I will say that I live on Cape Cod, and we just got our last frost at the very end of October, our first frost at the very end of October. And so we have a very long fall rose season, and nobody deadheads roses here because they are just so darn gorgeous in September and October that why would we cut them off? And so, and I see, you know, from rose garden to rose garden, those plants are allowed to bloom prolifically right up to their hard frost, and it does them no harm at all.
Number 35 is rusty nails make hydrangeas turn blue. Now, when I lived in the Portland area, that's where I had heard about this. Hydrangeas tend not to grow really well here in the colder climes of Utah. I guess they are coming out with varieties that will bloom on that year's wood instead of the next year's wood. But tell me about where this rusty nail makes hydrangeas turn blue came from.
Well, I think it's just a confusion of metals because it's actually aluminum that makes hydrangeas blue. And it is the pH of the soil. In acidic soils, the plants are able to absorb the aluminum, which is present in most soils. You don't have to add it. And so it's the pH that makes that aluminum absorbed, which turns the hydrangeas blue. And I don't know whether people just got confused, you know, that nails are metal and something to do with metal. Or, you know, maybe I could see maybe in the old days when people used nails that had a high amount of iron in them. And if you put enough iron in the soil, that can alter the pH to be acidic. So maybe that's where it came from. But I think it's just another example of, somebody trying something and seeing a result and concluding, I did A and I saw B, therefore A causes B. And that's a dangerous deduction in all of life, really. Sometimes A causes B, but sometimes it was actually C that caused B, or a combination of A, C, F, and G that caused B. So we have to be very careful about our conclusions.
Well, Utah soils are so high in pH, and my garden is somewhere like 7.8, 7.9. Mm-hmm. If I were to try to grow a hydrangea, it would definitely be pink. But this idea of I know here in our soils that iron is bound because of that higher pH. Would that be the same then for the aluminum? It can't pull it up?
That's right. They wouldn't pull it up. You would have to lower the pH of your soil either with aluminum sulfate, which lowers pH, or sulfur, which is a little bit gentler way of doing it for most gardens. So, yeah, it's another reason why in every region people are well served to get to know what the soil is like in their area. Where I live, if we do nothing, our hydrangeas are blue because we have naturally acidic soil here. You know, you test most soil in Massachusetts, it comes in around 5.5.
Wow, that's quite low.
Right. That's why we grow blueberries so well.
And why I tell people here, ignore what the big box stores are selling. Never plant blueberries in Utah.
Well, you know, it just makes sense to plant things that do well in your native soil. Yes, we can jump through hoops to try and change pH, right? But who wants to spend time doing that, right?
Right.
So it just makes sense to go for what we grow well, and then, you know, I can visit Utah to glory in the alkaline-loving plants, and you folks can come to Massachusetts to see things that do well in the acid soils.
And I love Massachusetts, so I'd love to come out.
Good.
I'm talking with Ciela Furnari. She's author of the new book, Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. We just have a few minutes left, and so I've got to make sure I ask you about clematis. You know, I've always been told plant the clematis with their feet in the shade and their tops in the sun. Well, as you explain in the book, it makes a whole lot more sense than the reason I was told.
Well, this is funny because this myth has led to great arguments between my husband and myself. He has always maintained that the way to shade clematis roots is with rocks. Now, he's a geologist, so, you know, there's no there's no mystery there. I, of course, being an out-of-control plant person, have maintained that the way to shade clematis roots is with other plants. And so this led to great discussions through the years. And then I spoke with clematis growers, and they all say to me, you know, you people are crazy that we raise these plants in black plastic pots in full sun on black asphalt or black landscape fabric, right? There's no shading of roots. But what's really going on is that these plants are not particularly drought tolerant. And so in their nurseries, of course, where they're raising the clematis, they water frequently. And I suppose it made sense before people understood that watering was the important thing. It made sense maybe to shade the base because then the grass or the area around the roots didn't dry up as quickly.
So it's not so much that the clematis needs to have cooler soil. They just want to have more consistent moisture.
They want to have consistent moisture. That's right. So we can all plant these vines out on the lamppost out in the middle of the yard in the full sun without anything around them. We just need to give them a, you know, nice layer of mulch perhaps on the top and a good deep soaking once a week.
I'm looking at number 51. It says, I need to do something before this spreads. And you have a picture showing some orange aphids on butterfly weed, and I had some orange aphids appear. I'm not even sure what the perennial is. It was a yellow flowering perennial, and I thought, oh. So I spent a couple of days worth of getting my hose and shooting a stream of water at the top of this plant to try to knock all of these off. But in the end, maybe I didn't need to do that.
I think probably you didn't. The thing is that most times, and not always, of course, but most times, nature does bring things into balance. You know, when there's an overpopulation of something like aphids, a predator, as long as you're not, you know, using the scorched earth policy and poisoning everything, a predator comes along and takes care of that overpopulation. Certainly a stream of water does not hurt. And aphids are curious that way. If you knock them off with a stream of water, they don't climb back on. Isn't that funny? But people, I think, often worry that if they don't do something about what they see, it's going to spread to everything in their landscape. And usually plant problems, insects, and disease are pretty host specific. And so it will affect, you know, the aphids might go for our roses, but they're not necessarily going to spread to every other plant in the perennial garden.
I love your number 57. A compacted lawn can be aerated with spiked shoes. And you spend a little more...
That's one of the quirky ones. So spiked shoes are very quirky. And in fact, I had to buy a pair of spiked shoes to take the photo for the book, right? And last weekend, we had a garage sale where I sold the spiked shoes. And I had a little sign on them that said, this is not a toy, right? And the man who bought them, he said, I'm going to give these to my friend as a joke.
Well, it's good because he understood that they really don't work.
They don't work. They don't go down deep enough. And not only that, but they make holes by compacting the soil, right? They push soil away from the spikes. So it's actually compacting it to the soil at the same time they're making those holes. So, you know, we don't have to look ridiculous by being out there stomping around with nails and being in danger of stabbing ourselves in the toes. The only way to really aerate the soil, well, there's two ways, with an aerator that takes cores out and, more importantly, organic matter. the organic, you know, the grass clippings, the compost, the organic matter from the top down. You know, this is how nature keeps soils aerated and good soil structure.
You could write a book on the fancy footwear. And that's the other thing I really enjoy about this book is the humor that you throw in with it. You said someone has invented slippers with handles sticking out of the heels so that the shoe becomes a cockroach swatter. And he said, And finally, my personal favorite for the Museum of the Hard to Believe are the shoes with the hollow heels that connect with a catheter for holding the wearer's urine. Don't ask.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I did was research patents, you know, on when I was looking through this book. And the number of patents for bizarre footwear are unbelievable. So if anybody wants to be entertained sometime, go on Google Scholar and search on patents for shoes and footwear. And through the ages, it's been quite amusing.
I'm going to end with number 68, which is beat a non-blooming plant with a rolled-up newspaper.
Bad plant. Yes, you hear this most often in regards to wisteria, but you hear it occasionally for other plants too, the idea being that shocking a plant will force it into flowering, and so one way to shock a plant is to beat on it. And while it's true that shocking a plant can force it into flowering, we see that here on the coast when we have a hurricane often in September, it brings every spring flowering plant into bloom. But beating on plants is not necessarily the answer. And we have to also remember that there are other reasons that a plant may not be flowering. And the main one is that that plant just might not be through its juvenile period yet. That all plants have a juvenile period during which time they cannot reproduce. And for some plants, that juvenile period is longer than others.
Apples seem to be notorious for taking forever in my garden to finally put on blossoms. I've got one recalcitrant apple that if it doesn't bloom, it's been in for 5 years. And I told it, you've got one more year and then you're out.
You know, is it a standard size apple tree?
It is.
The juvenile period for standard size apples is about 12 years.
Okay.
I'm just telling you.
Okay, well, I guess it might be coming out then.
The bigger the plant, the longer the juvenile period in general. So the larger the tree, for example, the longer the juvenile period is.
So,
and during that time, nothing we do, beat on it, fertilizer, nothing, will bring that plant into bloom.
So along with this, someone had told me, well, if your apple, and I haven't done it yet, but someone said if your apple tree is not blooming, you need to hit it with a baseball bat around the trunk to shock it. So it kind of goes along the same lines.
That's the beating situation. And I think you could just shock it to death. Now, since you're going to take that plant out anyway, I suppose you could take out your frustrations with a bat on that plant. But
I'd feel guilty.
I'd dig it up and give it to somebody who's willing to wait 6 more years.
Do you have a personal favorite myth?
Yes, I do. And that is that we should put rocks in the bottom of pots for drainage. This is something I did for years. This is something everybody's done for years. And it's not only unnecessary and a nuisance, it is bad for plants. And what I say to people is, have you ever bought a plant in a nursery or a greenhouse that has a layer of rocks in the bottom of those pots? No, you have not. And the reason you have not is commercial growers know it's bad for plants. When it comes to drainage, that's what the hole in the bottom of the pot is for.
I just tried to transplant a clivia that I've had in a pot for a little bit too long, but I had put pot shards in the bottom. I'll never do that again.
Yeah, that's why it's a nuisance, because you have to try and fish those things out, and the roots are holding on to them for dear life, right? And not only that, but, you know, the roots, the reason it's bad for plants is, as you saw with your clivia, the roots end up down in those shards where there's no water, there's no nutrition, there's nothing down there for them. So that's why it's bad for plants. And you won't find the commercial growers covering that drainage hole with a piece of screening or a coffee filter or a pebble, right? because they know that not only does the dirt not go out the bottom, but that's what the hole in the bottom of the pot is for, the drainage.
Well, CL, thank you very much for joining me. I've enjoyed our conversation today.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and C.L. Fornari is the author of Coffee for Roses and 70 Other Misleading Myths About Backyard Gardening. And she's a garden expert. And if I remember right, I read somewhere, did you have a radio program?
I do, and in Southeast Massachusetts on WXTK. So every Saturday morning, I'm talking with people about what's going on in their gardens out on the East Coast. As you, what day are you on?
I'm on Thursday mornings at 10, so it'll give me time to tune into yours on Saturday morning and listen in.
And is yours streamed online?
It is.
I'll be there next Thursday.
Great. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. We've been talking about seeds, and once again, I interrupt myself before I come back to the coconut to read from a book I borrowed from a dear friend, Faith in a Seed, the unpublished, until now, Journals of Henry David Thoreau. And I almost found the foreword and the introduction more fascinating than the unpublished journals of Thoreau. And so I will read quite a bit from the foreword by Gary Paul Newhan and the introduction by Robert D. Richardson. But I'll start with the epigraph by Thoreau. Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders. And then from the foreword, learning the language of fields and forests. In each of our lives, there is a time and often a person that sets us on a trajectory. At the time of my youth, when I wanted to be a poet and a biologist, those who were close to me, academic advisors, friends, parents, told me that I must choose between these two incompatible pursuits. Faced with this career choice between the arts and the sciences, my response was pure flight behavior, to withdraw from others, to walk for hours on end, and to read Thoreau. About that time, a friend offered me a retreat, a chicken coop that had been converted to a cabin. There I secluded myself, wrote, pored over biology texts, and read each morning from the journals of Thoreau. That morning reading ritual was among the most precious I have ever performed. Each dawn I would contemplate passages that Thoreau had written on the very same calendrical day 100 years before. As I worked at tasks throughout the morning, afternoon, and evening, Thoreau's words would burrow deeper and deeper into the soil of my soul, in much the same way as certain awned grass seeds twist and drill their way into the earth before germinating. Somehow, in some way, Thoreau altered my life then, for my course as a field biologist and writer finally emerged out of those months of doubt and difficulty. I interrupt myself here to say that I think that Brian incorporated Petals and Prose with the same thought in mind, that we can think about the science of plants, and he has guests who give specific and helpful information, but there remains still a literary aspect that needs to be present. And so Nancy Williams and I have the privilege of trying to weave the two together a little bit, the literary and the botanical. And so the author continues, in retrospect, I see that I became anchored by the steadiness of Thoreau's voice and by his persistent faith in the natural order of the world. In reading his journals, I gained a sense of how one might integrate a scientist's skill for detailed observation and a poet's command of language. In Thoreau, I first encountered someone who saw no polarity between poetry and nature's economy, but instead envisioned a vast ecology that spans both and enriches our senses, our hearts, our minds. It's not surprising that I feel a special connection with this remarkable treatise, The Dispersion of Seeds. The book which covers of faith in a seed, yet this book, which has taken more than a century to reach publication, is remarkable not only because it strikes a personal chord, but also because it conveys several important messages, not the least of which is that Henry David Thoreau did not choose between the arts and the sciences. Robert D. Richardson, Jr., who contributed the introduction to this book and who wrote Henry Thoreau, A Life of the Mind, has commented that Thoreau, Emerson, and their colleagues recognized no two-culture split between literature and science. They believed that to study nature and to know oneself came at last to the same thing which it was the purpose of literature to express. Accordingly, it can be argued that Thoreau began to rough out a literary ecology of North America, a work in progress that is still being shaped by dozens of landscape writers and literate biogeographers who are active today. Fortunately, other talented individuals followed in Thoreau's path to build ever stronger bridges between ecology and literature. From Vladimir Nabokov, John Steinbeck, Lauren Isley, David Ehrenfield, Barbara Kingsolver, David Quammen, Jean Craighead George, Robert Michael Pyle, they have written creatively about cryptic creatures, hidden habitats, and natural curiosities that they have encountered in their work as biologists and have enriched us all by exposing us to these seldom seen universes. It's ironic that Thoreau's involvement in purely scientific inquiry has been ignored for so long by so many and poo-pooed by few scholars of the American literature who were familiar with this hitherto unpublished work. Well, I'm going to go to the introduction by Robert Richardson now. Most of Henry Thoreau's work after Walden has never been published. When he left the pond, he said he had several more lives to live. One of these was a life of science about which we know very little. Thoreau's 354-page manuscript, The Dispersion of Seeds, his 631-page manuscript of Wild Fruits, his more than 700 pages of notes and charts of natural phenomena in Concord in the 1850s, and his 3,000 pages in 12 notebooks on Aboriginal North America remain unknown to the general public. And with a handful of exceptions, even specialists in American literature, the existence of these manuscripts is not a secret. They are, for the most part, raw material and rough drafts. Scholars have assumed that they deal with dry and unprofitable matters, that they present unsurmountable editorial problems, that they add little to what we know about Thoreau. The present volume is dramatic evidence to the contrary. In Faith in a Seed, Bradley P. Dean has meticulously assembled some of Thoreau's late natural history writings and placed as a centerpiece in the complete manuscript of The Dispersion of Seeds, the first new book of Thoreau's to appear in 125 years. It adds a whole new chapter to our understanding of Thoreau's life. The writer of Dispersion of Seeds has traveled a long road from Walden, although he has not yet gotten farther than Concord. Walden is perhaps our greatest celebration of the sweet freedom of a life in nature that is single, unattached, uncommitted. The Dispersion of Seeds, in contrast, celebrates fertility, fecundity, and interconnectedness. The Dispersion of Seeds is about the growth of communities and the rise of generations. Walden is the acknowledged masterpiece of Thoreau, the poet naturalist. The Dispersion of Seeds, even in rough draft form, is the culminating work of Thoreau, the writer scientist. I haven't even come to Thoreau's work itself, but I would like to close with just a final comment from the introduction. Louis Agassiz, his far-flung network of local specimen connectors as the years passed, Thoreau came to doubt Agassiz's well-known belief in the permanence of species. Agassiz was a famous European scientist, magnetically compelling teacher and lecturer, a scientific empire builder, the darling of Harvard and the rising federally funded science establishment, a minor, if reputable, local naturalist. Yet on the big issue, Agassiz was wrong and Thoreau was right. Agassiz believed that the facts demonstrated that the species were immutable and that species do not pass insensibly from one to another, but that they appear and disappear unexpectedly without direct relations with their precursors. In 1850, in a volume called Lake Superior, Agassiz wrote, "The more intimately we trace geographical distribution, the more we are impressed with the conviction that it must be primitive, that animals must have originated where they live and have remained almost precisely within the same limits they were created." The basis of Agassiz's work was not scientific, despite his claims. It was theological and has persisted as the theory of special creation. Agassiz believed that the geographical distribution of species was regulated by the limits marked out by the first day of creation. And so Thoreau takes him to task on this and turns out to be the scientist writer who was correct. It's a fascinating book, an unexpected contribution from Thoreau long after he lived. And I suggest that you try to get a hold of it. It's fascinating and I recommend it. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.